allows us to do. It teaches there are things that we cannot do, and it teaches there are things that we can do. So when I say liberality, I mean those things which we can do under the guise of the scriptures, nothing more, nothing less. The question I want to ask is three-part here, but it leads to a point. The difference in a strong brother and a weak brother, I want to know if I'm clear on what you feel about this. The weak one is the one who limits his liberalities, and the strong one is the one who understands his freedom under Christ's law and feels like it's okay to do everything that Christ says it's okay to do. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. As far as I can tell, it is.
All right. The second part is, in Romans 14, it seems to me as though Paul is teaching that if you have a brother in the congregation who feels like it's wrong to do something, that for peace's sake and for the gospel's sake, it's better that you don't do that thing and restrain from it in order to keep peace. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay.
Here's a certain thought.
Okay. I agree. Well, what point would you say that is?
When he becomes rebellious, he will not learn anymore.
Oh,
will not grow.
All right. Then the third question is, then, and I ask this, just I'm trying to learn for one thing, and if the church is actually doing this, I would like for us to take a good look at ourselves and see if this is what's happening. The third thing, then, is do we have the weak brethren in our congregations actually dictating what the law of Christ is?
Sometimes we do. I don't think all.
What can we do about that?
All the time. Well, you know, like I said a while ago, sometimes the weak ones are they really rule by they are strong so far as running over the brethren are concerned. Now, I don't know whether that answers your question or not, but we do have to really be careful in our relationship.
How do we tell them that this is what's going on if it needs to stop?
Well, Paul told Peter, James, and Barnabas to the face that this was wrong. And he would not tolerate it for an hour. When they got to the point to where they did this in a malicious way or in a rebellious way, then it had to stop.
Also, if you got weak leadership, you could hardly ever overcome these problems. Better just get out of them.
Benny, your talk was excellent, and I really enjoyed it. I've got one comment and then a couple of questions coming. I made you earlier. And I'll just make it for the general benefit. This weak and strong thing, as you pointed out, has been dreadfully abused in some cases. And we had a brother in 21st Street who got up publicly and said that because we oppose individual cops, we're the weak brother, and the aggressive is the strong brother, because we can go along with it. And I thought that was a very sad situation. Of course, we challenged that. Now, talking about food off the idols, some people might have the impression this is a problem in the old days. No, that was a problem we faced in Malaysia. The Chinese, for the most part, offer food to idols. The concept is that the food has a spirit, and therefore the spirits eat the spirit of the food. They do this in two ways. Sometimes they take it to the temple and then bring it home and eat it. Sometimes they take this food and wave it before the idol. Sometimes they light incense sticks and wave over the food. Now, the question is this. What does a Christian do when he goes to his parents' home? This was the tough question that we wrestled with, and I'm not sure we ever resolved it very well. You know, 1 Corinthians 10 says, if you go to a person's home, you sit down and you don't ask any questions. Somebody comes along and says, wait a minute, folks, this is food offered to idols. You've got to stop and say, no, I can't eat. Now, my point is this. The child goes to his parents' house. He's a Christian, they're not. He sits down. He knows that food's been offered to idols. They know it. The neighbor knows it. The postman knows it. Everybody knows it. Can he eat of that? Now, this question was brought to us by Lau Kim Hua. A lot of you know Kim. She's been here to study before. Also, we had students taking our correspondence course that would write to us and say, what do I do? There's a little twist in this thing, because we found that some, in the digressives mainly, were hiding their Christianity from their parents. And one lady who was about 30 years old had hidden it for 10 years. Now, had she taken a stand against food offered to idols, she could not have hid that. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to comment on that, and then I'd like to ask another question.
All right. I don't know. You know, this meat that was offered in the market, now, actually, that was part of that sacrifice that was taken there into the temple, dressed in all of the ribbons and all of the finery, and killed right there in the temple. And then it was brought out of that temple, given back to the offerer, and then he could take that and sell it to the market. It seems to me like that when he brought it to the market, that caused a separation between the temple and that idol up there in Paul's mind and in the Holy Spirit's mind. And so it was all right for them to eat that, unless a brother came up and said, this meat has been offered to idols. And then you had to do it not for your sake, but for that person's conscience sake.
Well, and the difference is this, that the person who's serving the food is the idol worshiper. You see, when you talk about the market, you've got a Christian going shopping, and he doesn't ask any questions. That we understood, and it wasn't a problem. The problem is this, this Christian's in the home of his parents. They're idol worshipers. They go down to the temple, and we've been in temples when they do this, and they take a chicken down there, and they offer it to the gods. Then they bring it home. Now the parents know where it's been, the child knows where it's been, the neighbor knows where it's been. What does that child do? And that's what I told them, that they couldn't eat it. That's what I told them. The other question I want to ask you, you mentioned Galatians 2. Now, you mentioned that it was wrong, or I believe you say it was a sin for Peter to do what he did in disassociating from uncircumcised Gentiles. Suppose that we've got a congregation that's Jewish, and in that congregation is one man who's very adamant about circumcision. Now, the rest of them are not. Now, we have a visiting Gentile Christian who's uncircumcised, and he comes and he wants to worship there. Can that one adamant Jew force the congregation to disassociate from the uncircumcised Gentile? In other words, can the weak actually have enough power to dictate terms of fellowship?
Well, it would be very difficult for us to say that it could. We're going to have to really consider a problem like that, because the conscience, in other words, there's no material thing that we have here on this earth that we ought not be willing to give up to save a person's soul. You know, what shall we give in exchange for our own soul? Worth more than the whole world. But I'm not prepared to say that one person can dictate that in a congregation in that particular way. I don't know that they even did that back there with one person. You had them coming. Well, that was your total membership then.
Yeah. What if this adamant brother has been, let's say, in the church for, let's say, 10 years? Don't you think that he's reached the point where he should have learned about circumcision, and that there is no way on earth that the congregation should bow to him and say, okay, you're the weak brother on circumcision, so we're going to not fellowship this Gentile?
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm setting you up, as you probably have figured out. And isn't that precisely what's happening with the no exception issue? Aren't we allowing a congregation in many cases who believes in the exception? We've got one man who's been a member of the church 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, And he's dictating terms of fellowship, and to me that violates Galatians 2.
Absolutely.
Let me ask something. Now, maybe I missed a term. Did you say that if these aren't hypothetical cases, then a lot of brethren may think, well, this is exercise of futility. We really face these cases over there. Did you say if a brethren, a Christian, went to his parents and he knew that that chicken had been offered and sacrificed to an idol, but he couldn't eat it even though there was no pronouncement made concerning it?
Well, what he said was that this is the idol worshiper, and this is being brought to that house with that in mind. And the parents knew it, the neighbors knew it, and the friends knew it.
Still, I don't think that violates that principle. Because in 1 Corinthians there, when he said, of course those people were offering that to the idol, but he didn't have to get involved until they made an announcement. I really, unless I'm missing something, think when he goes there, he eats at his food until some kind of an announcement is made concerning him. And then that forces him then to take a, you might say, a public stand. But until something is done in that particular area, he just goes there and eats, even though he knows what they're doing.
Well, in other words, you're saying that the announcement has to be made orally.
And in some way, yes, that's right. In some way, he said, this is being offered to sacrifice to an idol. At that point, he ceases to eat. Even though he knows what their idolatry is, he knows what that food ordinarily is used for. But he doesn't make a show of it. This sort of seems to me like what Paul said.
Well, maybe so. Now, did you say that woman had been doing that for 10 years?
Yes.
Did she change?
I don't know. I really don't know. I talked to her about it, you know, a little bit. But you know, sometimes they bring the Josh sticks. These are the incense sticks. And they wave them right over the table. To me, that's as louder than a verbal announcement. You know, they're doing it right there in everybody's presence.
Well, that's what I understood, that it was actually a part of the worship. But, I don't know, of course, we understand this about the oral announcement.
Yeah, that's easy. If they do that, you know, we know. It's this area in between that we wrestle with, and that, you know, it was a problem, and you know, that's the reason I brought it up.
Well, it wouldn't be a problem personally for me. I'm not trying to be disagreeable. But until that announcement was made, I would eat the food.
Well, would you eat, Jerry, would you tell them to eat if they came in and waved the Josh sticks with you sitting there and the family sitting there?
It wouldn't matter what they did until there was some kind of a pronouncement that involved me personally. But anyhow, it's an important area. The other brothers can bail us out. Let's see the things to Alex and then Taylor.
You mentioned something concerning Acts 21, where Paul comes back and they have this suggestion to him that he go with these others who have made a vow. I don't know if that's what you were making reference to. I just wondered if that occurred before he actually wrote some of his writings. You know, obviously he said he wrote some letters after that. And if after realizing what it was, you know, all that it was leading to, he started to...
Oh yes, you see, he had been on his first missionary journey and then come back and then go to Jerusalem, and this is where that pronouncement was made, and he carried it with him right on to Corinth when he started that church. And probably he had delivered that letter and the things that were there, but they still had that problem. They wouldn't give it up, along with about 12 or 15 other things that they had wrong there, according to him.
Yeah. I was making reference to some of the other letters where he deals with the same issues.
Yeah, well, most of it, you see, Paul didn't start writing his letters until that second missionary journey.
Yeah, but how about the prison letters, though?
Well, no, they were after that. They were the last. But you take 1 and 2 Thessalonians were probably his first epistles that he wrote. Then 1 Corinthians, maybe 2 Corinthians. Then, I don't remember the dates on the others. I've got them here.
Galatians.
They were all later than that.
Was Galatians written after this incident in Jerusalem where he had to shave? Okay. That's what I was wondering about. If Galatians was written after, maybe his reaction, the position he takes in Galatians is because he has already seen what it is leading to, and he, by, you know, he decides, well, this needs to be handled in a different manner because they aren't learning, they aren't growing to the maturity they should have acquired in all this time, and therefore, we need to stop it somewhere.
Yeah. That happened in Jerusalem. Let me see. Yeah, 50 or 51, right along in there. And also that about Titus happened about that same time. The Galatians wasn't written until 52 or 53. Just a little later on.
Taylor. Benny, it seems to me that the issue here is not who knows that the chicken has been offered as a sacrifice, or not how many sticks have been waved over it in your presence. The issue is your eating going to offend the conscience of a weak brother? That's what makes it sinful to eat the meat that's been offered in sacrifice. It's not the eating of the meat per se, regardless of what you know about it, or regardless of what anybody else knows about it. It is, and that's why I think Jerry has mentioned this business about a public pronouncement. You probably are not going to know that your action will offend the conscience of a weak brother unless he speaks up and tells you so. But it seems to me that that's the whole point of this argument in Romans 14, that until you know that your action is offending the conscience of a weak brother, it's permissible to eat.
Well, that's true partially. Now, Paul broadened his application of these principles to the Jew and then to the Gentile and to the Church of God. These principles could be applied in all of that area. Now, I think in this case that Alfred has brought up, that Paul would have gone a long way in, becoming a Chinese to the Chinese. But I don't know, Jerry. You know, we always say actions speak louder than words. Whether Paul, when they waved those sticks over them and worshiped to that idol,
well, go back to Acts 21 then, where he participated in that vow, and the passage says that he was at charge for these people. He evidently shaved his head just as they did, and a good many Bible scholars believe that there was an animal sacrifice involved in that ritual there, although it's not specifically mentioned in the King James Version, but or in the text so far as I'm aware. But he was obviously participating in something that was not Christian.
Well, now, that's true. And that has posed a problem for all of these people that I have read after on this particular subject. Now, as mentioned a while ago, that was a theocracy. The old Jewish setup was a theocracy. And Paul said, to the Jew I became a Jew. To those that were under the law, I became as one that was under the law. Now, these people were very zealous of the law there. But what Paul did, I believe he did it as a national Jew. I don't know that I could just really prove that to you or not, you know. But this is the way they raised their taxes, is through those sacrifices. And whether sacrifice was involved, Paul paid for it. Paul paid for the sacrifices that was to be offered for those men that were on vow with him. And so, maybe that's the answer to that.
Can I just ask one other question unrelated to this, but to make it something that we would understand in today's language, can you tell us very specifically some people that you would consider to be weak brethren today? What would a person have to do today in order for you to consider him as a weak brother?
Well, in parallel with those that we have under consideration, you know, that's an easier question to answer if we apply it over in Africa or over in Malaysia or someplace like that. Here in America, we might convert someone from a denominational church. They would be weak, they would be newborn babes in Christ, and they might try to bring some of their ideas in with them. In other words, they wouldn't separate themselves entirely from that. Well, I think we could treat them in a benevolent way, according to these rules. In fact, I think it's demanded that we do that, and not just boot them out if they don't conform to our ways immediately. I'll tell you one thing, I'm not going to sit there year after year and say, well, maybe he'll grow up someday. See, there comes a point where we have to stop that. Now, that would be one example that I think would be parallel with these people coming out of those old religions that they were in. Now, I don't know whether just picking up something out here and arbitrarily making it some kind of a situation in the church and then saying there's weak and strong revolving around this particular thing out here that we have just picked up that did not come from some situation like that.
Now I'm asking this as a question because this is something I've sort of gleaned from, you know, what you said. And that is that when there is someone who believes a certain way, that we should abstain from something like that. Like, you know, as Paul says, eating meat. That we should abstain from that, not to offend him, so that we can keep him in the church and teach him better. In other words, this is not something, as you said, which goes on for years and years. It's something, it's a means to an end. It keeps them with us so that we can teach them and make them stronger on down the line.
That's right.
Okay.
That's the whole purpose. You see, we've got rights, but along with those rights, there are responsibilities. If we don't discharge our responsibilities in that area, then our rights will condemn us. You see, people want to demand their rights. Well, that's what some of them were doing back there. They were demanding their rights of eating this meat. They didn't care if they ran roughshod over the brethren, wounded them. That word wound means strike against their conscience, like you're beating on their physical body. Well, they were just beating on those people's conscience. They didn't create an atmosphere of growth in doing that. Bill.
Benny, y'all brought up the no exception thing a moment ago, and you said that they abused the weak position. And we don't like it when the Cups people accuse us of it, you see. But then the same principle is true when we turn it on them, you see. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is, if you've got a congregation of sincere people who are no exception, who really believe the position, and I've worked with a few I think that do, how long can you work with them? I mean, they're probably never going to come out of that position. Do you think a person who's been married and divorced has a right to go in there and expect to be used with it? On this principle we're talking about. That they're abusing him, you see, divorcing him.
Well, you know, in our studies here and years gone by, I think we determined that it's a dangerous thing to make second-class citizens out of somebody who's scripturally right. I think there's something that has to, you know, really be done about it. And I think we should go as far as we possibly could, but there's got to be a point where that is stopped. If we're right, if we're scriptural, if it's, you know, if it's lawful, and there's no growth, and there's actually rebellion against what is the truth, I don't know. But it looks to me like that if we can apply these principles to it, that there has to be a strengthening of knowledge, and that's why the New Testament was given to us. And if truth won't prevail, then...
Well, the only way that we can dwell together is to apply that principle. And if there comes a point that you can no longer apply it, then we're going to have to separate.
I might say something here.
I wish you would.
You know, some congregations are against me for various reasons. Mm-hmm. But I know that I don't impose myself on for the sake of that, the unity of that body. Sometimes it may even involve a darkness point. But I don't think it would be right for me to know that a congregation has strong feelings to say on the non-exception and demand our rights in that church. Now, as long as, you know, fellowship generally is exercised, I would leave them alone. I wouldn't become a thorn in their side. I think that's the charitable approach, and I know we're expecting to grow. But I think as long as there's any kind of open door, any kind of interchange, I'd like to believe there's always a growth there. Or at least somebody somewhere will be in the room. But anyhow, that's the way I do it. If I absolutely know, I'm not going to demand that they use me or that I impose myself on them. If I already know what to put it. But I'm just passing that along. It's sort of the way I operate.
Yeah. Well, now, in your situation, you have a choice of going there. I'm not going there. And he's talking about somebody that's in that congregation that has been divorced and remarried scripturally. But it's there all the time.
Well, I thought maybe just someone that moved in on the deal and then said, well, I looked out of breath, you got to use me whether you want to or not. But it's a hard question.
Yeah.
Alan.
Now, Ben, up there on the board, you said, I think, that Paul said it's wrong to go in the idol's temple and sit down there and eat meat, right? He didn't say that was all right. In fact, it's wrong. But when the meat moves to the marketplace, I can go to the marketplace and I can buy that meat because I don't know whether it's been offered to an idol or not, so it doesn't matter. I'm just buying the meat, right? But if I'm in the temple of the idol, I'm participating in idolatry, and even if I'm not in my own mind, nobody else could make that distinction because it appears that I am, right?
Right. It's apparent.
Okay, now back to this Malaysian chicken. If waving those joss sticks over that chicken is part of idolatrous worship, then I don't think because of Acts 15 that Christians could sit there and eat it. Acts 15 says abstain from idolatry, and that's got to fit in this picture somewhere, which it does according to what you said a while ago. Even if no pronouncement is made, you can't sit in an idolatrous worship and take of it. Any more than you could go down there to the temple where they dedicate that chicken. I mean, I don't think you could. I think what Alfred told him was right.
Just grab it home. It wasn't a temple.
Well, yeah, but if it's idolatrous worship, it's idolatrous worship.
I don't know if it was invented, but in this particular case, they had gone, they were, you might say, invited to a feast. Paul spoke out on this and pronounced it exactly like he's talking about it. But if you get all that low and start working with it, you can just sound upside down everything you don't want to do. I'll go as far as the scriptures tell me I could go. If the brother comes, and these brethren didn't ask us, I can't tell it any more than the Bible says. I can't say, well, look, if you use Josh speech, you can't do it. Paul said if they say, and so that's the reason I stopped at that point. But it wasn't idols' temple.
But I'm just saying that Acts 15 hasn't been brought into this deal, and I think it should be, and I think it has further ramifications. One other little point, Acts 21, that Taylor mentioned, now that was not Christian. I mean, that participating in that Jewish deal was not Christian, but it wasn't idolatrous either.
What was the sacrifice?
Well, I mean, participating in the law, something that was originally under the law of Moses, even after the law passed away, I don't know if you'd call that idolatry. Maybe you would. I never thought you would.
Well, you know, Adam, one of the questions that really came up in my mind when I studied this, Ephesians and Hebrews had not been written at the time that Paul did that. And I had wondered that if they had been, if that part of the scripture had been revealed to him, whether he would have done that or not. My feelings are that he would have treated that just like he did Titus over there, because they seem to be a little stronger in that separation from the law than the other, than the other books.
And he added words of wisdom.